Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. My special guest today is Matthew Peters, who is Professor of Respiratory Medicine at Macquarie University and is also Head of Respiratory Medicine at Concord Repatriation General Hospital in Sydney. Professor Peters is the co-author of an editorial in the 20th of November issue of the MJA, which you can find at mja.com.au. We're talking lung health, the good news and the bad. Let's start with the obvious, which I guess is climate change in terms of lung diseases. What's changed and what effects have those changes had on the way lung diseases are developing and increasing?
Firstly, patients living with chronic respiratory disease who are breathless are going to be more breathless and functionally more impaired in a hotter world. This is simple knowledge. It's unavoidable.
What about in tropical areas where it's going to get wetter?
In tropical Australia, we can predict that there'll be a change in disease patterns. Melioidosis will probably move south. The effect of this, which is an important tropical infection, will depend in large part whether the organism comes across very receptive soil. There's a relationship between heat, very heavy rain periods, disturbance of soil, and for some reason we don't know the particular nature of the soil, so that, for example, even now Townsville has more of a problem than does Cairns, even though Cairns is further north. We may discover some of this complexity only with the passage of time. Generally, for respiratory and other diseases, we'll have to accept that more of Australia will be tropical and subject to tropical infection and even mosquito-borne infections, a problem not only for the lung but in other body systems.
Talk about a little bit, if you can, about the development of rural areas and how that might be disadvantageous in terms of respiratory diseases.
Clearly, governments are thinking about development of northern Australia. Some of that's quite controversial at the moment.
Yes.
And deservedly so. If we increase the population in tropical Australia, simply mathematics, if we do increase the population density in northern Australia, we're going to have to face the fact that more people are going to be living in areas at risk of tropical lung infections and other infections. It's a simple reality. Populating the north, disturbing the soil, deforestation, mining development are all a complex interplay. And to suggest that this is all going to be benign and not associated with significant respiratory and other illness is really rather far-fetched.
How does Australia stack up against its neighbours in Asia, for example, in terms of atmospheric pollution?
Australia is a very clean country, make no mistake. There are some areas of metropolitan Sydney, for example, particularly southwestern Sydney, where the sea breezes tend to flow and then settle overnight, that are particular pockets. Areas lining along major arterial roads have a moderate amount of pollution from truck diesel in particular, but overall, Australia's a pretty clean country. The meeting that we've got now going on is the Asian Pacific Society of Respirology, and Asia is a whole different story. We've had a lot of focus on air pollution in China, in Beijing, other areas of northeastern China, and the Olympics in Beijing, of course, brought that to a head.
Yes.
But Beijing is not as bad as Delhi, even this week as we speak. Absolutely horrific atmospheric conditions in New Delhi. These are conditions which are essentially not fit for human habitation, and we will have to think about, is this acceptable? If it's not acceptable, what do we do about it?
Yes.
And start making some adult choices and indeed supporting the third world and the developing countries into making choices which are for their benefit and for the benefit of one planet.
As the world gets smaller in terms of technology and communication and travel, those countries may bring their problems to us, mightn't they?
We see in particular in the area of antibiotic resistance that no country is an island. The inappropriate and widespread use of antibiotics in some areas has created almost untreatable infections. You know, we are winding back to a situation of, 80 years ago for some infections. it is important, I think, for both doctors and policymakers to actually reflect on what it was like to be a patient in the pre-antibiotic era, what people died of in terms of antibiotic preventable illness. Simple things like streptococcal skin infection. We're a long way away from streptococcal resistance, but one has to understand the tradition of barber surgeons with amputations for nasty cellulitis arose because when cellulitis was untreatable, people got ascending infection and died of sepsis. We're a long way, as I said, we're a long way away from that. But the reductions in pneumonia mortality that occurred in the 1940s only because of the availability of penicillin will be unwound when and if penicillin becomes resistant. There will be more deaths. Yeah, and you really have to go back to the 1940s when the doctors then described improved survival from the introduction of antibiotics to understand the extent of harm that will happen if that's unwound.
At one point in your editorial, you mentioned that with every American president, there seems to have been an epidemic of some infectious diseases, the last one being Zika, of course. There was a lot of publicity at the time Zika was happening about how good Australia's defences are and how we deal with something like that and not to worry, it's all good. Do you think our defences are good enough?
Well, we've been a little lucky in Australia in terms of emerging viruses in this time. We've had to deal with Hendra virus epidemics.
Yep.
These are mini epidemics, but of course have high lethality. We should, however, be mindful that epidemic infections spread at the speed of available transport. And that is ever the case. We got Spanish influenza long after Europe and America because it took a long while to get from Europe to Australia in a boat. The same was true of isolated Canadian communities where influenza in that era came when the rivers became navigable in the summer.
Yes.
And the postal canoe brought the infection. So, you know, we have a world where you can get anywhere in 24 hours. And that 24 hours may well be the incubation period for a nasty infection. US legislators that suggested a ban on travel between Zika-infected areas and the US should be implemented was quickly kiboshed when they discovered just how many people actively move each year from one to the other and how important it was, of course, for American business, for American tourism, for that to occur. That is our world.
Yes.
We have to be prepared for it. It requires vigilance. It requires a reality check every now and then. There will be an epidemic infection at some point during Trump's presidency. The epidemic is very like 12 months ago when Trump had won the election, but before he was inaugurated, a meeting was held with key advisors of his and important people in American government administration. The president's staff were warned of four major crises that he would face.
Yeah.
The first was a major cyber attack. The second was a major terrorist event. The third was an emerging infectious disease. And the fourth was one or a series of major weather catastrophes. He's already had two major weather catastrophes.
Yes.
These are the things that he was told to prepare for and we have to be prepared for. Yep. Well, we do have some advantages in Australia. It's unlikely that an emerging infectious disease will start here, but we're not far away from Asia where it may well do. It's a wonderful thing to be engaged with Asia, with Eastern Asia and with India.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're 8 or 9 hours away from someone bringing a very serious infection with public health ramifications to us.
Yep.
That is our world.
To go back to specifically to the lung disease situation, I mean, obviously, asbestosis, mesothelioma, all of those things have had a lot of publicity. Are we complacent these days about those? Do we think of those diseases as historical artifacts that are fading away?
It was one of the major public health successes of the previous century to identify the hazard of asbestos and eventually to stop its use.
Yes.
Tragic it stopped so late.
Yep.
But eventually we did stop its use. Interestingly, Canada, that continued the use of chrysotile asbestos, has now announced a ban effective next year. So we were 15 years ahead of them when we had a complete ban in 2003. The potential for asbestos related disease, specifically mesothelioma, is one that requires a great degree of vigilance. Mm. What we're seeing now is more distant exposures, exposures with failing memory, perhaps exposures that were lighter than the men who worked in mines or power stations. It was very obvious in mesothelioma,
yeah,
you know, 30 or perhaps 40 years ago. So it does require, clinical attention to detail in the investigation of people who may have a mesothelioma with pain, with pleural effusion. This will always be difficult. It won't be obvious necessarily. It won't be the first thought of even a competent clinician. So there will be delayed diagnoses. That's almost inevitable and arguably not unreasonable. But really, when something is not evolving as it's expected to, this is when the thinking hat really needs to go on.
Yeah.
The first thought in someone with a pleural effusion can't be mesothelioma. But equally, it can't be the last thought 3 weeks later.
We've seen the reemergence of a couple of things, aren't we, like black lung disease and silicosis now in tradies who are working with artificial stone cutting, for example. So it's always got to be up in the mind of a GP if somebody young, otherwise young and fit, wanders in coughing like somebody with silicosis.
True. There are many trends happening concurrently in this country. The mining one is a very interesting one, and I speak not from particular expertise, but one can understand that in the enthusiasm to dig up as much dirt as possible and sell it as quickly, perhaps a shortcut might from time to time be taken. That is a boom time problem.
Yeah.
Now, a bust time problem is when things get a bit harder in the mining industry. And again, there can be a temptation to cut corners. And a worker feeling vulnerable, mm-hmm. perhaps with employment not secure, may feel unwilling or unable to speak out about poor industrial hygiene. Go back to underground coal mining in recent industrial history. We did a great job in eliminating huge harms to working men, mainly working men, of course. We're not anywhere back to where we were, but equally, we shouldn't assume that everybody is equally susceptible and that lower levels of exposure in a particular individual may still have devastating consequences. When everybody was badly exposed, it's hard to pick out the one who would have still got disease even if exposure had been 10% of what he received. But we have to assume everybody is at risk and lift the standards of industrial hygiene consistently and verify that that's the case. And if necessary, then a monitoring program needs to be in place for the people who go into those workplaces, those who love and potentially care for them, and for the community more broadly to know that no one is being exploited inappropriately in a workplace setting.
So that's all pretty grim. Is there any good news?
Oh, there are tremendous positives.
Yeah?
Yeah, there are knowledge. One doesn't want to be too negative about things, but we do have to be cautious, and we need to know that there are key areas of improvement. Our understanding of lung cancer, for example, is hugely different from even a decade ago. We now see patients who would have died in 6 or 8 weeks living years and actually living pretty well with fairly simple and mostly quite tolerable treatment. So weeks to a few years is brilliant, and there's no reason why we can't extend that further. HIV infection was associated with a survival of a few years only in the 1990s. 2 decades later, a young person who is unfortunately finds themselves infected with HIV might have an expected lifespan of 50 years. So this is not quite as good as someone uninfected. But it goes to show that concentrated research effort, more disease understanding, innovative treatments, together, of course, with a public health program, can do fabulous benefits. And we have the skills to do all these things.
I was going to ask you about the novel therapies that are popping up, for example, cystic fibrosis and for tuberculosis too. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Well, tuberculosis is an area where we really do need novel therapies, and we may have one more antibiotic based on trials in Africa. If that comes to fruition, that will be great, not only because it's an additional drug to treat a bug which is becoming worryingly resistant in many parts of the world, but also it offers the potential for shorter course treatments, and we certainly need those from a practical sense. If we're able to get an effective vaccine against TB, and we could dream of having TB confined to a historical note.
How good would that be?
Smallpox almost is.
Yes.
That would be great. Again, why can't we do it? We just need to understand things better. We're progressively through science doing things that were previously impossible. We have new therapies for asthma that target much more accurately basic mechanisms of the disease. We have to learn how and when to use them, whether that's in a narrow, severe patient group or whether they should be used more broadly. And it would be exciting if we could spread the use of these agents to more broadly, an injection taken every 4, 6, or 8 weeks might actually be preferable to many people living with asthma compared with the tedium of taking their puffer once or twice every day, which we know they're not actually very good at.
Australia's pretty good at or has been pretty good at reducing the rates of smoking, which of course will have hopefully an effect on lung disease levels. What's your take on e-cigarettes and the way that's being pushed these days?
Have you got a month? E-cigarettes are a very controversial area. Until very recently, most of the major charities, and my view has been that we should operate on the precautionary principle that these products are not proven safe, and that on that basis we should be very strongly regulating them. My view has changed very dramatically based on emerging data.
Okay.
I believe now that there is so much evidence that e-cigarettes are harmful that we should be regulating them on the basis of known harm and not simply on a precautionary basis. The known harms are that there is at least a trebling of the uptake of smoking in young people who use e-cigarettes, that there is even in adolescents the development of respiratory symptoms, cough and sputum, around a 50% increase in the likelihood of a diagnosis of asthma, which is about the same as what you get from smoking in young people, and a very dramatic increase in the likelihood that a young person will miss multiple days of school from asthma. We are going to see deleterious effects of e-cigarettes most obviously in young people who have not been smokers. It will be devilishly difficult to prove e-cigarettes are beneficial or harmful in people who've been smoking for 20, 30 or 40 years. However, young people untainted by the harms of combustible tobacco use are a perfect observation platform. If we are already seeing harms in the lung health of young people who are using e-cigarettes for short periods of time, why would we not do everything possible to prevent their wider use in this country?
Boy, the vapors aren't going to like you, Matthew.
Oh, they hate me already. I think this is very important. We're at a signal moment, and Cancer Council agree, Lung Foundation agree, Thoracic Society agree, that we've moved past precaution. We are now at a point where we know they're harmful, and we should regulate them based on known harms.
Thanks for your time, Matthew.
Okay, no worries.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.